Christina.
Hey.
How are you?
Hey.
Hey.
Fantastic.
That's awesome. It's great to see you.
It's fabulous to see you. This is a snazzy shirt. It has little bunches of bananas all over it.
I
can hear is the banana boats.
I know. This is my most popular shirt. Every time I wear this, I should just like wear it every day, except then it would like, it would lose its charm. But I break it out like once every, I don't know, once every third or fourth podcast, and whoever my co-host is like, I like that shirt.
Give it a 10 out of 10. That's fantastic. And for listeners, this is a navy blue button up that has bright yellow bunches of bananas all over it. And it is a win. And it's an absolute fashion win.
It's what we do to distract from the bags under our eyes. We wear cool shirts or fancy hats or curly mustaches, stuff like that. I often say it's the vanity of aging, but no, it's just aging, trying to be graceful about it. What are we up
Someone
to
Someone who
today?
Studies aging, you know, it's
That's
better
right.
than the alternative.
That's right. You're the expert. The so as a senescence expert, you probably just like walk with grace all the time. Because you just have to be kind to people and you study them because it's nobody's happy with aging.
Expert is a strong word. Researcher. I like that. Then I can be as good or as bad at it as I like.
Okay, there you go. You're a senescence researcher, which we need. We need a lot more of those because we have an aging population and it's terrifying. So help us. Help us age gracefully.
Working on it.
But in the meantime, we're not actually here to talk about ourselves, are we?
Mm-mm, nope.
What are we here to talk about? Or who are we here to talk with? Who is in the waiting room?
We are here to talk with Taiye Winfull. Taiye joined the PhD program at Vanderbilt in 2018. She holds a bachelor's degree in molecular biology from Loyola University Chicago and a master's in anthropology from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Her master's thesis was entitled Reconstructing Africa's Evolutionary Histories, DNA Collection, Coding, Analysis, and Interpretation. In her thesis, she focused on generating a comprehensive bioculturally informed set of African DNA databases reflected continental and diasporic African genomic diversity. Desperately needed, very, very cool work. Taiye is absolutely brilliant. I know her through a friend of a friend of a friend. I've read a lot about her work. Very excited to be bringing her on today. Taiye's research interests are pretty broad. I mean, she's really, we talk a lot about straddling the line between the biological and the sociocultural, and she just does, and we were talking about grace, that she does that with absolute grace. So her research interests are everywhere. I mean, we're talking genetics, race, embodiment, health disparities. So talking about her research really centering on understanding life experiences and how they are translating into physiological symptoms, specifically via stress in Black populations. So her exploration, her research is really honing down the biological mechanisms that connect stress and health, with specific focus on how social and environmental factors can lead to epigenetic changes in inflammatory related biomarkers. So very, very excited.
Very cool. And she sent us an article that has been accepted in Human Biology, not American Journal of the UK one. It's called Bioethics as a Dynamic Issue, Holistic Approaches to Understanding and Applying Ethics to Study Design, which I love because she's comparing and contrasting American IRB to Nigerian ethics boards and sort of highlighting how they're culturally constructed. And given that I'm dealing with US and foreign ethics boards right now, it's like super resonant for me, as is she sent us a chapter from her dissertation. And it looks like it's going to be a series of articles, dissertations. So this chapter, it's chapter 2, called The Impacts of Stress on Salivary CRP Variability in a Nigerian Population, which I love, except she doesn't give us the result. She gets us there. It's like it stops right before the result. So I'm like, what'd you find? So can we bring her on?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hey.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Sausage of Science. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We are awesome. We were just geeking out on your work. We're super excited to talk to you today. I love you. Basically wrote two papers that are super resonant with what I'm going through right now.
Oh, yeah.
As I do IRB for Samoa, like three of them, and then get ready to go into the field to collect biomarkers, including CRP. So, and cortisol and all that stuff. So, yeah. Very, very resonant. And then, like, thinking about the sociocultural dynamics and how different they are from IRB to IRB. So we're super excited to talk to you today. Are you on spring break?
Yeah, it's I guess today's Friday, so today's the last day. Well, I have the weekend, but
yeah.
Well, so spring break.
It is also spring break for me, but I'm on sabbatical this whole semester. I haven't been doing shit anyway, so it basically doesn't count. But thank you for joining us on your spring break.
No problem. I'm happy to be here. So
great. Well, let's just jump right into it. As you probably know, because I know you've heard of us and we've heard of you, the show is a riff on how the sausage is made. We always want to know, like, what goes into the science, and we always start off with the scientist. So tell us about you. Where are you from? How'd you get into anthropology? How'd you find your way into these programs and to the topic that you're studying?
Yeah, so I grew up in, well, actually, I was born in Nigeria, left when I was 3, grew up in Minnesota, left at 18, went to undergrad at Loyola Chicago. And when I was there, I majored in molecular biology. But my first semester, I took an intro to cultural anthropology class. And I remember we read In Search of Respect. And I love the book. And I really, at that time, like I loved anthropology, but was too scared to like add it as a major or a minor. I typically like following an outline. I already had one in my head, so I didn't want to like make any deviations to that plan. But then my junior year, I took an intro to biological anthropology. It was a human evolution class. And midway through that class, I'm like, okay, I have to actually like add this major. So I added it as a minor. And then fast forward, it was time to apply to grad school. And I was originally applying to be a genetic counselor. And then they had a question on there that was like, why do you want to be a counselor? And I was having a hard time like answering the question. And I just thought to myself, like, I should just do something where I'm like really interested and like passionate about. I should do anthropology. Then I applied to some PhD programs, some master's programs, even though in hindsight, I should have just applied to the master's programs, but I applied to both, got into a master's program at UNC Charlotte, and I worked with my advisor at the time, Jonathan Marks, and he introduced me to really what I'm interested in now. I worked with Fatima Jackson at Howard, looking at African diasporic population, taking a biocultural approach, and then that really shaped the work that I'm doing now in my PhD at Vanderbilt.
So just a quick follow-up, this is a comment, not a question. You're basically at the end of a line of who's who in biological anthropology. So, wow, that's really impressive.
No, well, yeah. And even when I was applying to, I wasn't sure if I was going to originally apply to the PhD programs, because I think during my undergrad, when I was applying, it wasn't as successful. But yeah, he mentioned maybe I should apply. So I'm like, okay, I'll do it and just like see what happens. But then it worked out perfectly. So that was nice.
And you're working with Jada Ben-Torres, right?
Yeah. So
at Vanderbilt.
Yeah. I'm working with her, and it's been great. So yeah.
She's fantastic.
She really is. She really is.
So I want to start by start us off talking about this new paper, the one that was just accepted in Human Biology. And for our listeners, just as a little repeat, bioethics as a dynamic issue, holistic approaches to understanding and applying ethics to study design. Congrats on having this accepted. And in this paper, you're comparing US IRBs to Nigerian ethics boards. And yeah, you're talking about bioethics and ethical review boards more generally. How did you get started on this? What inspired this particular piece of work?
Yeah, so I think at the time that I wrote this paper, I was working on my prospectus. So it's been a little while, but at the time I was applying to the IRB in both my institution at Vanderbilt and then the institution I would be working at in Nigeria. And just through the application process, I saw some differences, some small differences, but they were notable between these two IRB processes or these ethical committee processes. And then I'm familiar with, of course, the United States and why the IRB is what it is today. So just naturally, I was interested in understanding how the history of Nigeria or where I was working, like the region I was working in, how that had shaped the IRB process. So just from applying, that's what really inspired me. Yeah.
So one of the things that was super apparent in reading the piece, right? I'm in Alabama. So every IRB experience for me, despite being extraordinarily bureaucratic and annoying, is undergirded by the knowledge that I'm in the state where the Tuskegee syphilis experiment was allowed to run for multiple generations and impact the lives of people who weren't even born when that was happening, right? So we have, like, every single time I get annoyed or my students are annoyed, I go, this is, we live in the land of Tuskegee, so just be glad that we have this. And it didn't occur to me until I read your piece that every nation or society is going to have its own sort of incident that causes a reckoning. What happened in Nigeria that led to the development of their ethics committee?
Yeah, so I think like there are a few incidences that really led to the development of these ethical review boards. And the main one that's really like that is often cited as like a primary reason that Nigeria introduced these formal bioethic committees are the Trovan trials by Pfizer. I'm just going to say Trovan because the name of the actual drug is, I don't want to pronounce it incorrectly, but like in 1996, at this time, Nigeria was going through an epidemic, and there were really a lot of cases of meningococcal meningitis. And at this time, I think there was roughly like 110 million people, but of this population, around 300,000 of them had, there were cases of having meningococcal meningitis, and then around 30,000 fatalities. So Pfizer comes in and really starts these unsupervised randomized trials of this experimental drug, which they were hoping would act as another way to treat meningococcal meningitis. And they run these trials with 200 children. So half the children are given the experimental drug, and then half the children are given the standard drug for treating meningococcal meningitis. So they're there for around like 2 weeks. They get what they need to get. They get their information, and then they leave, but they don't really share like the risks of the drug. They really fail to like follow up with the participants. They leave, and then also like around 5 to 6% of the people who participated in this trial actually passed away, and the other participants were complaining about health issues and then just inadequate information that was given to them. So that was like one of the major incidents that really influenced bioethics today in Nigeria. And then I think secondly, it just this trend of developed countries, I'm using like developed in quotations, but developed countries at the time really outsourcing clinical trials to like underdeveloped, again, like in quotations, countries. And this was happening a lot in Nigeria. And then just in general, we know that these outsourced trials can really exploit poorer countries who have weaker infrastructure, healthcare systems, issues with literacy, but high prevalence of disease. So of course, people are going to want to participate, but it just complicates their decision to like want to actually join these trials. And even at the time, like some of these trials were ethically like well designed, but at the same time, like these ethical goals, as we know them today, were not being adequately met because at this time, similar to the Trovan trials, there were no actual ethical like review boards in Nigeria. I would think those two incidences were really like pivotal in like the formation of these ethical review boards.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you do really well that I'm such a fan of in this paper in particular is you go beyond just talking about the Tuskegee experiments. One of the things that has always sort of frustrated me on a particular level is this, all of your intro ethics, bioethics classes are going to bring up the Tuskegee experiments. And while they're important, they are not the, you know, they're not the only time that these sort of tragedies have happened, these sort of massive violations of ethical considerations have occurred. And so I like that your paper brings up other instances of this sort of behavior up, talks about the outsourcing, particularly from the US to other countries in terms of doing these types of experiments and how that is continuing and the more recent instances of that occurring. So I appreciate that that is put in there. I'm also thinking, when we think about ethics and we think about IRB, in my training, the first thing I was told was, hey, when you learn to work with an IRB, when you learn to submit the paperwork you need to do, when you're thinking about your project design, understand that the IRB is there for legal purposes to protect the institution that you're working for. It's not exactly handling all of the ethical considerations. You will need to go do more. That was in my training. You're going to need to take it a step further. The IRB is likely not enough. And so I guess what I'm thinking about is how do you feel about how ethical review board processes reflect or maybe don't reflect the values of a society or a country?
So I think that, and what I was like trying to argue in this paper is that I think that these ethical review processes, like these IRBs, can tell us a lot about the histories of like a country or society or institution. And within learning about the histories, we can really see what these, again, communities, institutions, societies value. I think that, like, for example, in the US, we see that the IRB process is really like reflects the US's history of exploiting these vulnerable populations. And then now today, like modern protocols, procedures, and guidelines are really aimed at like mitigating what's been done in the past. In Nigeria, this ethical review process is really aimed at mitigating how Nigeria, for example, was really exploited because of potential like lack of resources at the time. They were really exploited by other countries. So really aimed at securing collaborations and funding like for work that you want to do in that particular like institution.
One of the things that I love that answer, by the way, and I like, one of the other things that I think is perhaps lost on, I don't know, I'll just call myself out as a white dude. We forget thinking about what vulnerable populations are. We forget the world is not the same as it is from behind our eyes. Like I look out and I see what I appear to think is a diverse culture with lots of skin pigmentations and classes and all this, but I have a very narrow bandwidth. And most of our IRB people are probably from different disciplines and stuff. So in terms of like how to describe to my IRB, and everywhere else, it's an ethics board, by the way. So those folks listening from outside the US, when we say IRB, ethics committees are the same. But the ethics committee, for instance, when I'm working in Samoa, like they're not thinking of themselves as the vulnerable population, right? So I'm having to write it in completely different ways. And I have had a few Nigerian students in my classes over the years. It's always funny. I'm always like, are there a lot of white people in Nigeria? What's it like when you see a white person? Do they like stand out? And he's like, yeah, we assume they're lost because we see it so infrequently, and we ask them if they need directions. That was just one of the examples. So yeah, like that sort of foregrounded for me, like, okay, vulnerable, who the hell is the vulnerable? I don't even know. I've never been there. So tell us what are some of the issues that these ethics boards contend with in writing them for two different cultures and countries? Like, what do you think is behind the ethics committee in Nigeria, for instance, in looking at your protocol? Like, how are they viewing vulnerable populations? I'm sorry, that's like all over the place. It's sort of how I ask questions, but
yeah, no, it's okay. I think that initially, me, because I am from Nigeria, I was born there, and I do go back relatively often to visit. So just naturally, I see that vulnerable populations in the way that we recognize it in the United States is going to be different than the way that it's recognized in Nigeria. And I think it was important to really contextualize these differences with like working with an actual community member. So I did have a collaborator where we talked about these questions. And I think that like particularly in Nigeria, even in talking with people, we see that like ethnic group affiliation or religion or class or these economic situations are really actually making people more or less vulnerable, rather than looking at race as this race or marginalized populations as we typically look at in the United States. So I think that was what I noticed just from experience, and also from talking with like my community collaborators. That's something to pay attention to.
Yeah, I just really can't stress enough for our listeners, this is a paper that you need to read. You should be thinking about all of the things that have been put into this paper and all the work that you have done here to pull out these important issues and highlight them and really juxtapose them against one another. You also give at the end of this some ideas about how these things could be improved, which I always love when conversation is happening around some things that really are problematic or could be improved, and then ending it with some of your ideas. So I really suggest that listeners take a dive into this paper. But I want to pivot a little bit to this draft chapter of your dissertation, and it is called The Impacts of Stress on Salivary CRP Variability in a Nigerian Population. And just before we jump in, can you give us a summary of your dissertation, the main objective, the overview, and then we'll deep dive into that chapter.
My main dissertation or my main interests are really looking at how like life experiences become embodied, in particular via stress, and how social and environmental factors impact both biological and epigenetic changes in inflammatory related biomarkers. And I look at two populations. So my fieldwork in Nigeria, where I collected saliva samples, interview data, and survey data, and then also in a secondary data analysis of African Americans living in Nashville, looking at electronic medical record data set through Vanderbilt. Broadly, I'm really interested in inflammation because it is a precursor to many health outcomes, and it has continually emerged as this promising mediator linking stress and health. I was particularly interested in focusing specifically on African diasporic populations. I feel like typically in like genomic studies or health-related studies, when these populations like are looked at, they're looked at like in comparison to like white populations, but like, I'm really interested in highlighting the diversity of experiences like within this population, and then how these experiences can influence health and health outcomes.
For me, since I'm doing similar work and I'm going to be citing you to help me understand my findings, and then for everybody else who's doing work like this, like I'm literally collecting CRP, which is C-reactive protein for listeners who don't know, you know, from saliva samples, all the same cortisol.
Yeah.
Interleukin 6, interleukin 1 beta, bacteria killing activity, alpha amylase. And even though I'm a researcher, I'm going to use Christina's words, not an expert. Like, I don't actually know how these all interact. And that's part of what we're exploring. But you provide some of this, you give us a nice hypothesis about how stress might be linked to inflammation and how inflammation might be linked to disease. I wonder if you could just sort of unpack that for us, so then we can go a little bit deeper into sort of the variability that you're exploring.
We do know that CRP and stress have some sort of relationship, but again, how this relates to like health outcomes is not as broadly understood. So in terms of my study, I really thought that I would see an association between stress, which was measured in the study using the General Health Questionnaire, which is like an international survey that's been validated across populations that measures distress. Participants are given the survey, it's 12 questions, and they can score between like 0 and 36. With 36, you're experiencing high distress, 0, you're experiencing relatively no distress. So I thought that I would see some sort of correlation between CRP and the survey. There are also some latent variables that some people actually use those variables instead of using the general health questionnaire as a whole. So one of these variables is anxiety and depression, and it has been shown that anxiety and depression is like heavily correlated with CRP when accounting for these other confounding variables. So I was thinking that in case that the general health questionnaire on its own was not like didn't show a relationship, I would see some relationships with these latent variables. Also, I don't talk about it in this paper, but I also was looking at epigenetic changes in IL-6 and how that relates to the CRP production. because typically like highly methylated regions, like not always, but they do inhibit transcription and like consequently gene expression. And we know that IL-6 like is a key regulator of CRP. So really just like playing with that relationship and seeing what I find, which is like a different chapter.
I need that chapter. Yes, I'll be looking for that to help me understand what I'm actually doing.
Yeah.
Hurry up, write it down.
It's written. I just have to,
That's what I tell my advisor every day. It's written. I just have to, we see each other.
Yeah.
I
guess.
Mm-hmm. I have doctoral students. I understand. Yeah.
Uh-huh. We've all been there. I want to focus in about, so much of your work is about comparing different populations and how their biology might or might not differ, their biology might respond to different stressors. And what do we know about variability and inflammation in different populations? I know a lot of biomedical research, particularly historically, is focused mainly on white US populations or weird populations. What do we know about variability and inflammation?
We know that like minoritized and racial ethnic groups have higher levels of these circulating inflammatory biomarkers. And we know that, or well, we see that consistently in the literature, Black populations have higher levels of these inflammatory related biomarkers. But again, when compared to white populations, and we also see similar patterns, but they're not all, but the evidence is mixed with Hispanic and Asian populations, where sometimes the levels of CRP or other inflammatory biomarkers that we see in these populations are either higher, like similar to Black populations, or they're equivalent or comparable to what we see in like white populations that they're usually compared to. But just in general, like the biological mechanisms underlying these differences, again, like remains understudied.
So the cool part about reading your bioethics paper first is that I got excited because I was like, oh, I understand now why there's a difference, I think.
Yeah.
And then I was looking forward to your results, and you left us on a cliffhanger. You gave us the chapter of methods.
Yeah.
And your results are somewhere else. Are you going to tell us what you found?
Going back to the general health questionnaire, in this study, it wasn't a significant predictor of the variability I was seeing in salivary CRP, even when I looked at those other latent factors as well. And that was surprising to me because I think on its own, the general health questionnaire was an accurate measure of stress in this population, like doing some other statistical analyses. So I thought that there would be some sort of like correlation or association, which there wasn't. But that really just highlights again how potentially this questionnaire is measuring or only accounting for a part of the stress experience in this population and not the totality of how these people are experiencing their stress, which I also found out during, I also like collected again some interview data. So seeing like what actually makes people stress in this population, how they define stress, that was helpful in thinking about why potentially this questionnaire was not a significant predictor of the CRP variability. So I think that was something that was interesting for me to think about. Also, where I collected my samples was located in the southwest region of Nigeria, but it's at a teaching hospital. So a lot of people from other surrounding regions come to that hospital. And region was a significant predictor of CRP variability in this population. Specifically, like being from the northern or eastern region was a significant predictor of CRP variability. Typically, people in the southwest region are people who identify as being like Yoruba, from like Yoruba land. And in the northern region, these people are typically Muslim, or typically in the eastern region, it's called like Igbo land. So there is something in these experiences that is potentially making the differences we're seeing in these patterns. So that was interesting to at least like start to think about again, like how experiences within populations, they're really impacting variability, what we see.
I love that. So you're doing truly biocultural work, or, you know, I don't know if you, maybe four field. And I had a similar experience in Samoa, like, and I want to emphasize the importance of like going to the field and doing this sort of ethnographic work. Cause when I went to Samoa two years, I don't remember when, anyway, I just went and gave a talk to tell them what I was thinking about. And they were like, we don't think about stress the way you guys think about stress. Right. Like, so you, like, how are you doing the study? And I'm like, I'm going to ask you guys. They're like, okay, good. Cause we don't experience, like, you guys think of stress like when you don't accomplish something or something doesn't come to you. And we experience stress when our family is having issues. Cause our family is what we identify as our well-being, not ourselves. And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty profound. That's important to know.
That is so important. I think that I'm really interested in this biocultural approach and thinking about like well-being or health as more than healthy and not healthy, but thinking about like health in this more holistic sense of well-being. So talking to people was really important to me, and it has shaped how I'm going to like approach this, like the next iteration. So I think that's really important.
What is the next iteration? Are you have a defense date yet? Do you have plan? And you're never supposed to ask that, but they made me ask that. Are you interviewing? What's next for you? Because you're moving fast.
I don't have a defense date set up yet, but the summer, that's what I'm shooting for.
That is like tomorrow.
I know.
Are you looking forward to it, or are you nervous, or both, or all of the above?
Well, yeah, all the above, definitely all the above.
So we always end the show the same way. Now, this will come out after the meeting, which is next week. And I just told Christina that I'm ducking out because I have this impending field work that I have to prepare for, and I'm sort of overwhelmed. So thank you for that face, Christina. I appreciate it. But next year we'll be back and bolder than ever with our new logo and song and dance ready for the talent show, which used to happen, and we want to get it going again. So if we do, what talent might we hope for you to entertain us with? And mind you, we have had everything from germinating seeds to parallel parking. So the bar's pretty low. We actually had somebody else also say, I will be at the bar down the street. That's my talent. So,
well, I used to play the clarinet. I played it for like 8-9 years. So I could do that. Also, I like karaoke. So that could be my talent as well. I love karaoke.
So we'll get Melanie Martin running the bar. That was her talent, mixology. Okay. And you get the karaoke machine running. And we actually have a party.
A party.
Absolutely, especially if you throw a clarinet in there, it is not a party until you've got drinks and a clarinet going.
Oh yeah, once people get liquored up and pull out their old band, you know, oh, it was in band.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah,
we will need a bouncer though. That party's gonna be
dirt flying, people parking cars.
Ty, are we gonna see you at the HBAs this year?
Yeah, I'll be there. I'm doing the poster session like 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on the 20th. Yeah.
Which it'll be after the fact, but what's your poster? People can probably go find it online, I assume.
Yeah. Well, it talks about this chapter that I sent. So what we've been talking about today is the poster.
Awesome.
Love it. Yay. That is so good. It's been a true pleasure having you on and chatting. Very nice rapport. Joy guests that just are easy to talk to. You can find us, dear listeners, on the interwebs. We're on the Human Bio Association is humbio.org. We're on Twitter X at humbioassoc. I'm at Chris_ly. We are now also on Instagram, Threads. We're on Facebook. You could probably just Google all that stuff. Christina, are you on the internet to be found?
I am on I'm a tweeter or X or how, whatever you want to call it, at an Xer at Christina Gildy. You can find me there, and all of this will be in the show notes, dear listeners. So you can check us out. Ty, what about you? Where can we find you on the socials?
I'm also on Twitter, TWinAnthro. Yeah, that's my Twitter.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
And we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you.